We're going to make sure that we defend international territories from being taken over by one country.
South China Sea islands become the early focus of the Trump presidency. It's Thursday, January 26th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Indonesia's tougher sex offense law is in effect. U.S. financial markets soar to record levels. Commerce and ecology on the Mekong. Modest and massive Vietnam Tet bonuses. Cash in right now as we get started with VOA Asia. China's foreign ministry is urging the new administration of President Donald Trump to respect the facts, speak and act cautiously to avoid harming peace and stability of the South China Sea. A foreign ministry spokeswoman said China staunchly protects all countries' freedom of navigation in accordance with international law and staunchly protects the peace and stability of the South China Sea. The comments came a day after White House spokesman Sean Spicer was asked if Mr. Trump agrees with his Secretary of State designate Rex Tillerson, who told lawmakers the United States will have to send Beijing a clear message that its island building in the South China Sea must stop and its access to those islands will not be allowed.
I think areas in the South China Sea that are part of international waters and international activities, I think the U.S. is going to make sure that we protect our interests there. So it's a question of if those islands are in fact in international waters and not part of China proper, then yeah, we're going to make sure that we defend international territories from being taken over by one country. I think as we develop further, we'll have more information on that.
After Tillerson's remarks, Chinese state media warned that unless the United States was prepared to wage war, preventing China from access to those islands would be foolish. University of New South Wales Professor Emeritus and international consultant Carl Thayer tells VOA's Victor Beatty, while the new Trump administration has yet to form a coherent policy, he is taking his cue from the new defense chief, James Mattis.
Because I would refer to James Mattis's testimony to the Armed Services Committee. And prior to that, last August, he released and signed a report for the Heritage Foundation. He listed the South China Sea in August as one of the top issues, third or fourth. And then in his testimony, he really said that the administration had to find a way to make the rule of law conform. So his was a much more nuanced one. Now that we have Tillerson confirmed, Mattis has been confirmed, we can now get some coordination, I think, via the cabinet and the national security mechanisms to come up with a policy. Tillerson's remarks were off the cuff, apparently. I mean, it was an answer to a question, and they were taken very badly in the region. I think what we're hearing now is not a step back, but a slightly more nuanced position, where I think the best position, and that's the man that would have to do it, James Mattis, talking about how to bring American interests and international law into conformity with each other. And it's true. The Arbitral Tribunal has ruled there's no basis for China's nine-dash line. Two of the features that China has occupied and built airstrips on are low-tide elevations that were ruled not subject to appropriation. In other words, they belong to the Philippines. But I don't think the Trump administration is going to get support from President Duterte.
I know it's early, but how do you see the trajectory of U.S. policy under the Trump administration with regard to the South China Sea?
Well, I think greater priority obviously is going to be given to China and the economic relationship, market access, and the so-called currency manipulation issue. These statements on the South China Sea have been made, but what has not been addressed is that the one ally most concerned, the Philippines, has completely stepped back. And there's been no comments. I mean, if President Trump wants to criticize American allies for not carrying their weight, it's not the NATO allies I'd be looking at. It would be the Philippines themselves, where there's not only a treaty, but an enhanced defense cooperation agreement that under Aquino saw the positioning of American aircraft, ground attack, and the growlers that deterred China over Scarborough Shoal. They're not available if we take Tillerson's words literally, and the U.S. wanted to stop access. It would need basing in the Philippines to be right on the scene.
Carl Thayer anticipates a more robust U.S. policy in the South China Sea, similar to what occurred under the Obama administration last year, when Western intelligence warned of decisive and provocative Chinese activity at the contested Scarborough Shoal. He said that activity did not occur because of a strong U.S. response. These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Trump uncertainty fuels South Korea nuclear talk. United Nations says North Korean airline facing growing restrictions. China to push Mandarin language for minorities. Trump invites Indian Prime Minister to visit later this year. Slowing trade, rising protectionism add to Asia's economic uncertainties. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. In October last year, Indonesia's parliament enacted a regulation to revise the 2002 law on child protection. Under strengthened provisions on child sexual offenses, defendants accused of sexual attacks on children could face the death penalty, life in prison, or, for male offenders, chemical castration with female hormones, combined in some cases with imprisonment. After release from prison, offenders could also be ordered to wear a tracking device. Suspects in the rape and murder of a 5-year-old girl in Serang Papua on January 12th may be the first to face the death penalty under the new tougher law. VOA Asia's Steve Miller and VOA Indonesian reporter Eva Masrieva discuss its implementation amid recent high-profile crimes.
Actually, this is not the first case that was happening in Indonesia. So in the past 1 year, actually, we have so many violence against women, especially children. It's not just a violence like in the domestic violence, but it's also rape and also a killing. And the rape is now is also getting worse because they have like more than 10 perpetrators.
Just
like
right. It's not just one individual committing the crime of rape. We're seeing increased instances of gang rape.
Correct. So the last one that you mentioned in Sorong, it was not as bad as what we faced in 2016, where there's a young girl who just come back from school and then was raped by 16 adults, and then she was killed. Because of that case, then the government started to implement what we call as the new Child Protection Law 2016.
So under this new law, what's changed in terms of the punishment of perpetrators?
Yeah, usually we in a sexual violence case, we only have the maximum penalty only for the adults. But then there's so many people raise questions about what happened if the perpetrator is a child himself. I mean, it's under 18 years old. What should we do with him? That's why the government tried to increase the age of the perpetrators that can be convicted in the court. So it's not only under 18, but if it's under 18 and then it's too bad, I mean, the crime is so severe. What should we do about that? So the government now try to put more
stringent penalties in
place. Like the castration or even putting the assembling an electronic detection tools in their bodies, in their foot. So this kind of changing that we have in our law.
The death penalty, the chemical castration, and some other things are sometimes very controversial penalties in various parts of the world. How are people in Indonesia responding to this new law?
Yes, the nation is so divided. I mean, some of the human rights activists still criticize the government about using this castration or even putting the devices in their body as something against the human rights. But then some other part of the nation also thinks that we should give a fair treatment to the victim itself. I mean, if the victim was mass rape, I mean gang rape, and then killed by the perpetrators, what should we do to make it fair for the victim and the family? So it was the big controversy in Indonesia. But then the human rights activists also said that actually this kind of law, the child protection law, is not really protect the children and the woman itself. Why don't the government also take more initiatives like creating more secure place for the woman to go from home to school or from office to their home, or even educate people to be more respect to women? Because in Indonesia, we have the patriarchy system where women's always in the second class. Even we cannot walk in the same path. Even if we serve in the same job, we don't have the same payment, this kind of thing. So the human rights activists suggest the government to educate people more, to be more respect about women.
Is the government working towards that at this time?
Yes, the government tried to work towards that. But as I said, because of the patriarchy system, it's not so easy for the government to do that because they also face with the what we call as a radical Islamic society where people always think everything based on their religion, where in religion, women should respect men more than what we have to do. So this kind of thing become a big challenge for the government.
Eva Mazrieva from our Indonesian service, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Happening now in Asia, authorities in Wuhan have sentenced 9 residents to jail for resisting police in a raid and will be imprisoned for 2 to 10 years without the chance of appeal. Elsewhere, rights groups called for the release of lawyer Xie Yang. The groups say that he was tortured while in police detention. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's such a pleasure to have you with us today on VOA Asia. U.S. financial markets are soaring to new records as the Dow Industrial Average has hit the much-anticipated 20,000 milestone. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino is with us to explain what that means to the United States and the global economy.
Jim, it was quite an open this morning. In fact, the futures market pointed to an over 20,000 open. What's interesting is if we look at the broader markets, in the past 70 days, we have not seen a down move of 1%. And this is being fueled by Trump's pro-business policies, confidence in the market in general. And in fact, actual growth and accelerating economic indicators are translating into a lot of support for this market. It's going to be really interesting to watch the dynamics between the U.S. and China, because even before Trump came in, China really is emerging as the globe's largest trading partner. They are expanding significantly into Africa between infrastructure spend and investing in the local economies in general. Africa, out of all the continents on the planet, has the most growth potential in terms of population and technology. And China is really moving into that space. So I think to completely seal us off from the rest of the world isn't necessarily the best policy, but I certainly do appreciate more Americans back at work fixing our infrastructure, teaching new skills for jobs that are reflective of today's economy.
The strength of the dollar also impacts our ability to trade overseas. And we just saw China open up a new rail line into Britain.
Right. Well, what happens is when you have a stronger dollar, it's going to impact your multinationals like Nike, like General Electric. And we're starting to hear that in forward guidance from these types of companies, that the higher the dollar is, the more it impacts currency fluctuations on the balance sheet. And that's what's going to hurt these global multinational companies. The theory is if we do more work in the U.S. and focus our attention there, that could impact some of that currency impact to the balance sheet.
As we look at the company's forward guidance, we always look forward to guidance from Jill Malandrino in New York. Jill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Vietnamese authorities arrested human rights activists last weekend. Thuy Nha was charged under Vietnam's Article 88 for allegedly, quote, conducting propaganda against the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, end quote. The United Nations condemns the use of Article 88. This and other stories are on Steve Miller's Asia Minute on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia continues. The Thai government is backing a plan by China to demolish islets and rocky outcrops on the Mekong River as part of a decade-long project to boost shipping navigation from China's Yunnan province to Luang Prabang in Laos. The project, known as the Development Plan for International Navigation on the Luang Kang Mekong River, is set in 3 phases. The navigational improvements cover 630 kilometers to make the river passable for 500-ton cargo vessels. Philip Hirsch is a professor of human geography at Australia's Sydney University. He says clearing of islets is the last major obstacle for large vessels to ply the river.
The key site, which NGOs are focused on and which local fish are the most concerned about, is this set of rapids on the stretch of river between Cheng San and Cheng Kong, called Con Pi Long, because if they can clear that area, then there's very little left by way of obstacles for larger ships to go all the way downstream.
The plans have triggered protests from scientists and conservationists like Robert Mather, who says destroying almost 270 different islets or outcrops is potentially devastating for the river's aquatic diversity, with about 200 species of fish living along that stretch of river.
These are areas very important for fish breeding, feeding areas, you know, because you've got things growing on the rocks and on the islets. They're, you know, important. You know, the end result of what's happening is it's making the river, you know, more like a canal, really, isn't it? It's making it easier for navigation. It's making it more uniform, right? So the diversity of different habitats will be reduced.
A coalition of local environmentalists representing eight Mekong provinces has launched a campaign opposing the plans. Pinapon Dietz, Thai campaign director for the U.S.-based International Rivers, says the wider impact of the plans is on local communities.
We are now seeing the Mekong to be like a buffet for different companies, different government agencies to take to build their projects and to make their profits without considering the richness, the complex biodiversity and the ecosystem.
Conservationists say China should further develop highway links from China to Laos as an alternative to sending cargo by river. China's plans to boost navigation on the Mekong River date back over 25 years. Do you live or work along the Mekong River or in the area? How do you feel changes in the river impact you? Let us know on Facebook at VOA Asia. Developing at this hour in Asia, South Korea's Constitutional Court Chief Judge urged the body to wrap up the impeachment trial against President Park by March 13th. This because he retires this month and another justice in March, reducing the court to seven justices and the possibility of the ruling's legitimacy. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, it's that time again, time for millions of people to celebrate the Lunar New Year as we usher in the Year of the Rooster. In Vietnam, year-end bonuses are common. They're anticipated by workers across the country, and this year, there's a little bit of controversy. VOA Vietnamese correspondent Ha Nguyen is with us to explain.
We call it Tết, the Lunar New Year. Tết bonuses are big things in Vietnam. At the end of the year, a lot of workers, they're looking forward to that those bonuses at the end of the year. And they see that as something to give back to what they've done throughout the year. They work hard for that, so they're really looking forward to those bonuses. And that's also a promotion for what they've done. And the employers always use those bonuses to encourage workers.
Sure, because the more productive you are, perhaps there's something at the end of the year for
you. Yeah, in my story, I mentioned a company in Vietnam. They decided to give eight mid-level managers a car worth a billion dong, not dollars.
Okay.
Which is equal to around maybe $45,000 or $50,000.
That's a nice car.
And so far, yeah, it's a very nice car. And so far, it's one of the biggest bonuses for Tết.
I would think
holiday
so.
Holiday gifts.
Yeah. Yes.
But at the same time, you know, workers somewhere, they get very little bonuses, maybe about like 100,000 dong, which is about $5, around $5.
So we're talking some people get a car and some people get $5.
Yeah. So that really reflects the big gap in incomes in Vietnam right now. Recently, the General Statistics Office in Vietnam released a new income. Vietnam is a middle-income country. At the end of December, the average income of Vietnamese people is $2,200. So the income, you know, the average income is getting higher and higher, but the gap between the rich and the poor is also
growing very quickly.
Yeah, quickly.
Right. Well, I mean, if somebody gets a car worth about $45,000, that's 20 times the average earning.
Yeah.
Has that created some controversy?
Oh, yeah, of course. Every year there are, I've heard about, you know, the strikes, the protests from workers because they're not satisfied with the bonuses mm-hmm. they get at the end of the year, although they work very hard.
Is this prompting workers to perhaps try to pressure employers or the government to make changes so that maybe they are compensated a little bit better at the end of the
year?
Well,
the government tried to make the companies report about the bonuses they're giving. But so far, the government cannot do anything with that mm-hmm. because private companies, they decide to give the bonuses.
However they choose.
However they choose, sure. Yeah. There's no rules for that.
If somebody was not happy, I guess they could just decide to work for somebody else. If
yeah, that were the and case. That's the agreement between the employers and the workers.
Mm-hmm. Great story.
Yeah.
Han Nguyen, thank you.
Thank you.
And as we get closer to the Lunar New Year on Saturday, we'll have more stories about the big annual event from different parts of Asia and how it's celebrated. We also invite you to leave us your comments on our Facebook page. We've been telling you all along, it's called VOA Asia. You can leave your comments. We might read them on our program. You can also send us audio or video greetings from your phone if you'd like. We'd love to hear from you. And perhaps you'll be able to be a part of our program. Our Facebook page is available to you 24 hours a day online. You can also find us at voanews.com. We send out our special thanks to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Carl Starling. Our managing editor is Diane Gao. And of course, our great VOA Asia team, Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, and Eli Zimmerman. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 21, 2013, Syrian government forces fired rockets containing the chemical weapon sarin at two rebel-controlled areas of Ghouta, a suburb of Damascus, killing hundreds of people and injuring thousands more. Amid the global outrage that followed, and despite vehement denials of responsibility for the attack, the Syrian regime accepted the Kerry Lavrov framework, joined the Chemical Weapons Convention, and relinquished its declared stockpiles of chemical weapons. Nobody was held accountable for the deaths and terrible injuries of thousands of Syrians in Ghouta, nor have any persons been held accountable for the chemical weapons attacks that have continued since the Ghouta incidents. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, United Nations Joint Investigative Mechanism, had been established by the UN Security Council to investigate incidents of already confirmed chemical weapons attacks in Syria, and mandated to make attributions for a number of confirmed or likely chemical weapons attacks. In August and October of last year, it issued reports determining that the Syrian regime, specifically the Syrian Arab Armed Forces, used chemicals as weapons against the Syrian people in three separate incidents in 2014 and 2015. For this reason, the United States government has imposed new sanctions on Syria. On January 12th, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control designated 18 senior officials connected to Syria's weapons of mass destruction program. The U.S. Department of State also designated the Organization for Technological Industries, or OTI, under Executive Order 13382, a sanctions authority from 2005 aimed at freezing the assets of OTI, which belongs to the Syrian Ministry of Defense, is involved in furthering Syria's WMD-capable ballistic missile program, and has been producing components for missile built by the Syrian Scientific Studies and Research Center, the key entity responsible for Syria's WMD and missile program that was previously designated in 2004. As a result of this action, all assets of these individuals and companies that are under the jurisdiction of the United States are frozen, and U.S. persons are prohibited from engaging in transactions with them. The Syrian regime's use of chemical weapons against its own people is a heinous act that violates the long-standing global norm against the production and use of chemical weapons, said Acting Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Adam Zubin. Today's action is a critical part of the international community's effort to hold the Syrian regime accountable for violating the Chemical Weapons Convention and UN Security Council Resolution 2118.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.